47 in the book. I encourage you to read the introduction. And I want you to know that there will be a much more detailed introduction to the Kuzari that will be taking place tomorrow evening. But the function of this class, the purpose of this class, is a text-based instruction in the Kuzari. The Western world was divided between Christianity and Islam. And the only exception to that rule was this territory called Khazaria, or the Khazars, where an entire country decided that its national identity was going to be Jewish. And the irony was is that the people of that land were themselves not Jewish. They converted en masse to Judaism, and that essentially is the story of the Khazars. The Khazars no longer exist. They were overrun and their territory conquered primarily by a people known as the Rus, which were the forerunners of the people who founded the country that we know today as Russia. They were actually Vikings that came from Scandinavia down, moving southward and eastward into Europe. And they were extremely proficient in land conquest because of their great maritime knowledge. And as a result, the Khazars were basically obliterated from history. One of the questions that has to also be discussed is what happened to the Khazars. And by the way, we'll discover what this has to do with this book called the Kuzari in just a second. But the word Kuzari comes from the word Khazars. And it's spelled K-H-A-Z-A-R-S, the Khazars. It's a fascinating study, which is really not a Torah topic, but it is a Jewish history topic as to who the Khazars were and what happened to them. One of the reasons why this is extremely relevant, however, which should be the topic of a completely separate discussion, is that there is a theory that is still quite popular to this day that most Ashkenazi Jews are descended from the Khazars and are really not authentic Jews. So if you're a Sephardi, you have nothing to worry about. But if you're Ashkenazi and you have fair hair and blue eyes and things like that, so there's a good chance that you're a mongrel or there's and by the way, this is quite a serious subject because it has been used in a lot of propaganda that is propagated by Palestinians as well as white supremacists to talk about how the Jews of today are imposters and interlopers and the Antichrist and things like that. So that's a whole other discussion. But we have to move our world, we have to move our minds back into the 12th century, which is when Rabbi Yehuda Halevi lives. He's born sometime in the latter half of the 11th century. According to most historians, he is born in the city, or raised at least in the city of Toledo, which is somewhere in the center of Spain. Surely, God willing, I'll try and bring you a map of 12th century Spain at some point in our studies. We'll be able to get a better perspective. Maybe I'll do that for Wednesday night. When I discuss some of the history. And Spain in the 12th century was divided between Islamic rule and Christian rule. The majority of Spain, probably about the bottom two-thirds of Spain in the 12th century, were under Islamic domination, under a kingdom or a provincial rule known as the Cordoba Caliphate. The word caliphate is the term used for Islamic monarchy. And as a result, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was born, as were many great rabbis of this period of time, including Maimonides, was born into an Islamic world that is very, very different from the Islam that we see in the world today. The Islamic world in the 12th century, particularly the Islamic world that was in Europe, that was a certain kind of Muslim known as the Umayyad Caliphate that had migrated from Syria and had moved its seat of power into Spain, as the Muslims knew it, as Al-Andalus, were extremely intellectual, scholastic, and quite tolerant of other faiths. Very different from what we would associate with Islam today. When we look at the Islamic world today, we associate that more readily with people who are intolerant, who are extremely violent, who are given to the execution of minor criminals, and who have nothing kind to say about Jews or Christians. But the world was quite different back then, and in many ways, history plays tricks on us. And in certain ways, the Islamic world was actually much more welcoming to Jewish immigrants that were coming from the Middle East than the Christian world was. And you have to remember that that in the Christian parts of Europe, going further north in Spain and in the Rhineland, which is France and Germany, and then even going further north to Britain, there were not only persecutions, but a century before there were great crusades, and the Jews were massacred en masse. And so Christian Europe had a very, very unfortunate and negative history with the Jewish people. And Islamic Europe did not have that same level of religious persecution. It was just starting as Rabbi Yehuda Halevi entered into adulthood, and it was one of the reasons that historians suggest that he decided to leave Spain later in his life, in the year 1140, when he made Aliyah. And on his way to Eretz Yisrael, he stopped off at a number of different communities on his way there. He traveled through Egypt, and there were a number of Jewish communities in Egypt at this time. And we're not actually sure if he ever made it to Eretz Yisrael. There are many historians who say that he died in Alexandria in his attempt to make Aliyah, and there are other historians who argue that no, he actually did make it to Eretz Yisrael, but he only was able to live there for about 2 or 3 months, and he was never heard from again. The presumption is that he was either died from sickness or he was killed in some mishap. There's of course the very romantic and famous account of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Shortly after arriving there at Israel, he touches the stones of Jerusalem and kisses them and says, Sion, halo tish ali lishloma sirayich, O Zion, will you not inquire about the welfare of your inhabitants? And just at that moment, an Arab horseman came along and trampled him to death. You may know that those words, Tzion halotish ali lishloma sirayich, were composed by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. As a matter of fact, in some circles, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is better known as the great poet more than he is known as the great philosopher. One of the things that we're going to try, and I hope I'm just riffing now. There's a free flow of ideas now. I haven't really organized the lecture for today, at least not in the introduction to the Kuzari. What we have a tendency to do in the Jewish world today is something that's very natural and normal for the human psyche, but also is sometimes unfortunate. Because what we tend to do is that we take historical events and historical people, and we superimpose our image of what Torah and Yiddishkeit are supposed to be based upon our own understanding of what Torah is today, and we sort of superimpose that image upon people who lived a millennium ago. So you know, of course, the famous question, how do you know that Moshe Rabbeinu wore a shtreimel? Did you ever hear that question? You know how I know that he wore a shtreimel? What, Moshe Rabbeinu wouldn't wear a shtreimel? That's the answer to the question. So how do you know that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi ate kishka on Shabbos? Yehuda Halevi wouldn't eat kishka? You know, so we have a tendency to think that Judaism has been static, and that the way it's being practiced today, and the way that we daven, and that our attitudes towards the secular world, and many of the cultural sort of idiosyncrasies that we possess in the Western world, is the North American world of Orthodox Judaism, is something that goes back to time immemorial. And one of the things that I hope that you'll be able to appreciate in the course of studying a little bit of medieval Jewish history from the great authors like Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and like the Rambam is an appreciation of the fact that the way that we think today is unique to our world, even in some of the hashkafas that we harbor, as far as what's acceptable and what's unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And you have to understand that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi had a certain affinity towards poetry, that if we were to find a Rosh Yeshiva today who would be writing certain kinds of lyrics that had to do with a woman's beautiful red lips, and we would say, this Rosh Yeshiva doesn't belong to be a Rosh Yeshiva. He shouldn't be a rabbi, right? And yet, sometimes we'll find that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's poetry is of a much more romantic genre, because that's the world in which he lives. It's a romantic time. It's Spain, after all. And it's the time of great romance. It's the time of great, it's just a very, very fanciful period of great art and great aesthetics. And so these kinds of things that we would find to be unacceptable for us to see in a rabbinic personage, a truly God-fearing person, are things that we will find somewhat foreign. But none of the things that I'm discussing about Rabbi Yehuda Halevi are to be found in the Kuzari. What we're going to discover is a great, great Jew who is brimming with pride in his Judaism. And as a result, of that brimming pride, Sefer HaKuzari has been embraced by all different kinds of Jews throughout history. It's been embraced by religious Zionists because of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's great affection for Eretz Yisrael and his emphasis and his declaration multiple times in the Kuzari that the only place where a Jew can find spiritual perfection is in Eretz Yisrael. Try to do it outside of Israel, you'll only reach so high, but it'll pale by comparison of your spiritual achievements that are possible in Eretz Yisrael. It's been embraced by Hasidus, because Rabbi Yehuda Halevi emphasizes the whole concept of joy as being a far more superior form of service of Hashem than serving Hashem through fasting and self-affliction and crying and tears and things like that. And it's been embraced by great intellectual Jews because of its confrontation with the great philosophy of its day. And so therefore, it has a message for all of us. And I don't know whether I want to give any more introduction right now. There's a ton of stuff to discuss. Mm-hmm. But I'd rather, because this is a textual class, I'd rather the text itself to speak to us first, and then be able to derive some of these messages from the text directly. And so perhaps what we'll do is we will ask someone to read out, who's a good reader? Someone who has a British or South African accent and who can make it sound extremely sophisticated. And we'd like you to be able to read out the first paragraph, and let's see what Rabbi Yehuda Levi has to say. Please just say it out loud. Page 47. Yeah. Yes, but we're going to read it in English, if that's okay. I want you to know we're going to read this text in English. Let me explain to you why we're going to be reading it in English, okay? The original text of the Kuzari is not Hebrew. Rabbi Yehuda Levi wrote this book in Arabic. He wrote it in Arabic because that was the language of the Jews of his time. Arabic culture and Arabic literature was embraced by the Jewish people to such a large degree that Jewish writers were writing their Sfarim in Arabic, just like many Jewish writers write their books in English for an English-speaking audience. Rabbi Yehuda Levi's objective will become quite clear in just a moment after we read the first paragraphs, and then you'll understand who his audience is and why he's writing this book. And that's perhaps probably the most important thing that we need to discover is, who is your audience, Rabbi Yehuda Levi, and why did you write this work? So go ahead, please.
I was asked to provide refutations to those philosophers and religionists who dissent from us, including Jewish sectarians who dissent from traditional Judaism.
Thank you very much. Are you reading from my translation?
Page 47.
Yeah, okay, good, okay. I thought maybe I had a different edition, I wasn't sure. But anyway, now the question, of course, is, thank you very much, who asked Rabbi Yehuda Halevi? He says, I was asked to provide refutations to those philosophies and religions that differ from ours, including those sects of Judaism that descend from traditional Judaism. So already we have been given a glimpse at Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's objective here. This book would either be called a polemic, or an apology. It is a defense of Judaism against its detractors. So the question then becomes, well, who was detracting Judaism in the 12th century? And the answer is that there were detractors from without, and there were detractors from within. And that becomes apparent from this very first paragraph. The detractors from without are a society that it would be incorrect to call this society secular. Today we live truly in a secular society, which is for the most part godless, a society which tries to write God out of the story. But that was not the case in Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's time. He was living, as I mentioned, in an Islamic society. Well, what does that have to do with philosophy? And what does that have to do with religion? Well, religion we understand. Islam and Christianity were the two dominant religions in the area where Rabbi Yehuda Halevi lived. Just a little bit north of where he was living was the magical land of Aragon with mystical Christianity. That would be eventually where the Ramban, where Moshe ben Nachman, who would live almost a century after Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, would call his home. And he was living in Christian Spain, so Christianity was well known to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. But primarily Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was living in an Islamic society, and Islam was also presenting challenges to the Jewish people. We don't have that much historical record of Jews who decided of their own volition to go ahead and convert to Christianity and to Islam. It really didn't seem to be something, there was no Jews for Judaism back then, where there were people who were missionaries who were trying to convert Jews to Christianity and Islam by showing them the truth of Christianity and Islam. Most Jews understood that Judaism was the original. It was the best for them, and there was really nothing that Christianity and Islam had to offer other than the fact that there was tremendous pressure bearing down upon people from society to convert to Islam or to Christianity. Even within an Islamic society where there was a greater level of religious tolerance at this time than there was in the counterpart Christian world, if you really wanted to advance within society, you were going to need to be a Muslim. Because no matter how successful you were as a Jew, you were still known as a dhimma, which is the Arabic term for sort of the non-Islamic citizen of our society, who must be treated with a certain level of tolerance and respect, but at the end of the day is a second-class citizen. We do find that many, many Jews that lived in the Islamic Europe were able to rise to great political power, but with limitations. We find the same thing in Christian Europe. One of the greatest examples is Rabbi Yitzchak Dan of Abarbanel, who rose to great prominence as one of the ministers of King Ferdinand, but met with a very sad ending when the Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492, several centuries later. So you see that this was a very, very tenuous time for Jews. There was pressure, and the pressure was mounting. At this time, in the early part of the 12th century, there was general tolerance. At one point, however, Spain was overrun by Berbers, a certain kind of Muslim that was coming from the African continent that was much more fundamentalist and violent. And as a result, only a few years after Rabbi Yehuda Levi wrote the Kuzari, many Jews were forced to flee Spain and migrate to Egypt. That's what happened to the Rambam's family. That's why even though the Rambam was born in Spain, his family, when he was just a boy, ended up having to move to Egypt. So you see things are very, very tenuous over here. And even communities that are living in peace together with Muslims are facing constant pressure to convert to Islam. What does he mean by philosophies? And this is probably the most important issue that we have to discuss, and that is that while normally if one were to ask the question, is Islam today known for its great study of philosophy, that would sound like a joke, right? Because we associate Islam with fundamentalism. What's important to understand that Islam developed in a very, very interesting way, very different from Christianity. Christianity had always prided itself as being a religion that was the enhancement of the original faith of the Bible, and that it was really sort of the disciples of Yashki were the chosen people that had received their transference from the original 12 tribes of Israel, and that special quality of chosenness, known as supersessionism, where there was a replacement theology where Christians really replaced the Jews as being the chosen people. And as a result, in Christianity, the primary emphasis was always on the New Testament as an enhancement and an augmentation of the Old Testament, and those were the texts that we needed in order to be able to discover truth. And Christians always therefore viewed themselves as a continuation of a seamless enterprise that goes back to the revelation at Sinai. The Muslim world didn't have it that easy. First of all, Islam starts from a place where there are very, very few Jews and no Christians anywhere. In the middle of the earliest part of the 7th century, with a guy who's neither Jew nor Christian named Muhammad, who lives in the Arabian Peninsula, and has an epiphany that all of the stories of the Bible have been distorted over the centuries by Jews and Christians. So there's a certain amount of truth to them, but he was taught this new revelation of what God's will was in all of the historical episodes contained in the Bible, and he records the true or correct version of those stories and commandments in the Quran. As a result of Islam's relative newness, and as a result of its need to show that it is authentic, there seems to have been within the consciousness of the Islamic world a desire to harvest as much knowledge and wisdom from all civilizations of the world in order to augment the religion of Islam. And this is something that, you know, historians discuss more extensively, that Muslims had sort of like this inferiority complex at this period of time because they were the new kid on the block, and they therefore needed to emphasize the sophistication of Islam despite the accusation that they came from a backwater land, a very uncivilized place, having absolutely no connection whatsoever to the revelation as it originally had happened as recorded in the Bible. And so there is this tremendous drive to connect to whatever past wisdom exists, not only from Judaism and Christianity, but also to connect with wisdom of the Greeks as well. And so we find, beginning around the 8th century, which is really just 100 or 200 years after the formation of Islam, and Islam takes hold, catches on like wildfire throughout the Middle East, and then spreads through Africa, and then eventually making its way to Europe. But it was wildly, wildly popular in a very relatively short period of time. And during those incipient stages of this new religion called Islam, a number of Islamic scholars took upon themselves to study and to translate the works of Plato and Aristotle and a whole line of Greek philosophers who they felt carried a certain gravitas and granted a certain legitimacy to Islam that would make them at least on par with the other, certainly Christianity and certainly Judaism. And so we look into the world of the medieval Islamic world, in Europe especially, and we find an extremely erudite, scholastic kind of Muslim scholar who knows as much about Aristotle as he does about the Quran, and is prepared to try and explain God not only in religious terms, but also try and explain God in philosophical terms. And it's very important to appreciate that medieval philosophy's endeavor, its project, is to try and explain the existence of all that exists with the assumption that God, or some higher power, whatever you're going to call him, is part of that existence and is the progenitor and the cause and the mover of all that exists. So Muslims, by and large, feel, and to varying degrees, that you can very easily integrate Greek philosophy into the Islamic mindset and make it compatible with the teachings of Muhammad and the Quran. So Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is faced with this world, and there is a sense of condescension that one detects in his words, that he feels that he is being condescended upon when you read some of the Kuzari, in that you get a sense that he feels that Judaism is viewed by the parent culture as being somewhat primitive and backward, because whereas we Muslims have been able to move forward and advance the world of Greek philosophy and the sophistication that it carries with it, the Jews have remained mired in their Talmud and their biblical texts, which are ancient, which are archaic, which do not offer the same level of intellectual sophistication as the world of the Greek philosophers. And so therefore, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is as much trying to defend Judaism against Islam and Christianity, to the extent that he does, this is a polemic against Islam and Christianity, it is even a greater polemic against Greek philosophy. Greek philosophy as transported to his world by the Islamic world. As you will note, as we go into the text of the Kuzari, you will be able to discover that a relatively short amount of space is dedicated to try to refute Christianity and Islam. Just a few pages of the Kuzari. A lot of people who have heard about the Kuzari think that it's a book of defense of Judaism against Christianity and Islam, because the first five or six pages are all about this disputation that a pagan king has with a Muslim and a Christian. But when you read the book in its totality, you'll see that's just the first few pages, and the rest of the book is dedicated to arguing most primarily against the world of the Greek philosophers. So that's philosophies and religions that differ from ours. That's the threat from without. That's the threat from the outside world, the non-Jewish world on the outside that's threatening Judaism. And then the part that he says, and those sects of Judaism that descend from traditional Judaism, he's referring to the Karaite world. This was a sect of Jews that had begun in the Middle East sometime in the 9th century, and it was sort of a carryover, sort of a rekindling of the world of the Tzedukim. The Tzedukim were a sect of Jews that lived during the Second Temple period, towards the end of the Second Temple period, who denied Torah Sheba'al Peh. They believed that the rabbis of the generation had falsified information about an oral tradition, and therefore felt that it was necessary to look only and exclusively at the Torah texts, the Tanakh text, the Torah Shebichtav, in order to be able to get the truth of Judaism and what God expects of us. And the Tzedukim, as we've discussed in the past, eventually were basically never heard from again, primarily because with the destruction of the temple, they lost a tremendous amount of power, because the Tzedukim's Judaism was very much temple-based, whereas the Judaism of the Prushim, or the Pharisees, or as they later became known as the rabbis, was able to find a way to continue flourishing even after the destruction of the temple. So ultimately, the Tzedukim died out. Their brand of Judaism died out, never to be heard from again until about 800 years later, when a group of Jews, begun by certain very charismatic leaders, put forth the argument once again that the Talmud and the rabbinic Judaism that we have today is a falsification and really is not the authentic form of Judaism that God wants us to use, and it started to gain some adherence and strength and it started to gain some momentum. Ironically, part of the reason why it gained momentum is because there was a very great rabbi in Bavel at the time who just took it upon himself to rail against them and write against them. And some historians actually look back on this period and they say that this great rabbi just decided to ignore them, then they probably would never have been able to galvanize and to unify and to coalesce into one solidified movement known as the Karaites, that's the Karaim. The word Karaim, by the way, comes from the word Kore, because they were textual. They only believed in the textual Torah, in the Torah Shebichtav, and they rejected Torah Shebaal Peh. So sort of a cautionary tale for many of the experiences that we have today, and that sometimes thou dost protesteth too much. Sometimes if you try to argue too loudly against a certain group of Jews that you disagree with, you end up only legitimizing them further, and therefore sometimes the best strategy is to just ignore them. And when to apply that and how to apply that is not something that's done so easily, but I'm just put it out there. But in any event, by the 12th century, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says the Karaites are a formidable entity. They have gained a certain amount of strength both in the African continent and in some parts of Spain, and we have to contend with them. There are whole Karaite communities that have a variant form of Jewish expression, and they have argued that our Torah Shebaal Peh is not legitimate, and therefore we need to address those as well. We will see that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi will not address the Karaites until the third essay. There are five essays in the Kuzari, and it will not be until the third essay that he will devote most of the third essay to a defense of Torah Shebaal Peh, of the oral tradition. Okay, so now that we know who his audience is, now remember, Judaism is taking a bit of a beating. Can you just imagine Rabbi Yehuda Halevi looking into his community and seeing all of the youth that are going to whatever schools they're going to? They probably didn't have any yeshiva day schools back then, but they probably had parents who would gather together and teach their kids ad hoc. They would teach them Torah, and they would gather together in the shul, and they would daven together and learn the texts together. And there were centers of yeshivot, but mostly of higher learning. A lot of medieval Jewish historians discuss what kind of scholastic systems did exist, and there's still a lot of controversy as to what kind of school systems existed during this period in Jewish history. We know that there were certain yeshivot of higher learning, and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi himself spent some time in one of them, but just imagine for a second, you have these kids who are very, very exposed to the outside world because there's constant interaction with, on a mercantile basis, and relations with the Muslim community, and there are constant in the written word, which is Arabic, there's a tremendous amount of poetry and a tremendous amount of sophisticated writing. And by contrast, the literature that the Jews have does not have that same level of sophistication and what we would call sophistry, that certain very, very appealing kind of literature, very, very high, highly stylized and very sophisticated kind of language. And so this becomes somewhat challenging. You know, when you have an outside world that presents itself. It's just like our universities today. You know, a lot of our kids go off to university, and they find themselves very much seduced, I guess is the right word, by professors who are atheists and who present themselves as being extremely intellectual. And unfortunately, we, as and I speak for myself, and we rabbis don't always do a great job as presenting ourselves as the great sophisticates and the great intellectuals. And as a result, when our kids want to discuss truly deep philosophical issues, some of us, and many of us, most of us in the rabbinical community, are ill-equipped to really deal with the big issues of life. And then when we present it to our professor, and he talks about, you know, Bertrand Russell and Nietzsche and all of these, and Aristotle and Socrates and Descartes and all of these great philosophers of the ancient world and medieval world and the modern world, and talks about how they viewed God and they viewed the purpose of life, and then they talk, and then they go to the science classes and cosmology, and they study all of these very, very just amazing things about the big issues, about what the world is all about and what reality is, and we come from that, and evolution and all of these other very, very important discussions. A lot of times in the rabbinic world, we've sort of buried our head in the sand and figured, you know, well, that wasn't a subject that I learned in yeshiva, so I'm not equipped to deal with it. And so there's really no one in the rabbinic world, very, very few people in the rabbinic world, who are equipped to really deal with those very deep theological and ideological questions that our children have. And Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi decided to write a book to try and address the theological dilemmas that he perceived the children of his generation, and perhaps some of the adults of his generation, were facing as a result of some of these very seductive and alluring sources of knowledge that were taking place in his world. So that's why he writes his book. Now we know. Okay. Should we take any questions at this point?
Yes, please. Who was the rabbi who wrote about against the Karaite, like a rabbi that we know?
Well, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi himself is... Oh, you're asking me who was the rabbi? Rabbi Sadia Gaon. Rabbi Sadia Gaon was a great opponent of the Karaim, and he wrote very, very strongly against them. Some historians, I don't know if this is accurate or not, but some historians have suggested that in retrospect, the Karaites were basically a very disorganized, discombobulated group of Jews who were not that literate, and had he left them alone, they probably would have just faded away. But instead, because he came out so strongly and forcefully against them so publicly in the Jewish world, basically they were incentivized to sort of get their act together and come up with a united front against rabbinic Judaism. Okay. Yes?
You said that Islam was spreading quickly, but yes. Because they were murdering people if they didn't convert, or because it just spread?
Well, yes. I mean,
didn't Muhammad go around killing everyone that didn't want to convert?
It was a violent religion. It was a violent religion. And you have to also appreciate that politics and religion were really two sides of the same coin. The world viewed your national identity in terms of religion. So, and the quickest way to assimilate a newly conquered territory was to indoctrinate them to the ways of your theology or your faith. That was the way. In other words, let's say we've just conquered a country that speaks a totally different language. So how do we get everyone on the same page? Well, now it's going to be Arabic, and Arabic is the language of what? Of the Quran, and that's the text of Islam. And now that unites everyone automatically. So the way that that world conquerors united their kingdoms was by having a national religion or an empire religion. That's the way the Roman, the Holy Roman Christian Empire operated, and that's the way the Islamic Empire operated. And it was through, most of the time, it was through forced domination of these other countries or city-states. Yeah. Yes?
Did Rabbi Yehuda Levi feel that he was intellectually sophisticated enough to tackle at that time?
Yes, absolutely. As we'll see, he had a tremendous amount of knowledge of Greek philosophy as it was interpreted in the lens of his time. There's a much larger discussion, which is, how did Greek philosophy evolve into the 12th century. It was not the same Greek philosophy of what it was in the times of Aristotle. It had morphed to some degree, but it was the conventional Greek philosophy of his time. He was extremely well educated. He was extremely worldly and was very, very familiar with the texts of the philosophers. He had studied the greats of the Islamic world. He had studied Al-Farabi, and he had studied Avicenna, and he had studied the texts of Aristotle themselves as they had been translated into Arabic. And so he felt eminently qualified, as did the Rambam as well. What we'll probably discuss in one of our Wednesday night discussions is the very dramatic difference in approach that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi and the Rambam took in attempting to dispel the myths of Greek philosophy. And in a nutshell, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi rejected Greek philosophy as having nothing to offer Judaism. And the Rambam took almost the diametric opposite approach, which was to say that Greek philosophy is completely consistent, or not completely, but mostly consistent with Judaism. Okay. So then let's take a look now at our, we'll wait till the second paragraph till next time. Okay, so that we really got far today, I'm glad. Made a lot of progress.